Game On on 2FM with Green Fern. Naturally good food packed with protein.
Thanks to Jenny Green. It's Monday the 21st of September and this is Game On.
Coming up today, after he swanned down the Champs-Élysées, what will Sam Bennett's success do for Irish cycling?
Trying to lead out the world champion. Bennett's on his wheel. Here comes Viviani. Who's going to win this? Pedersen goes. Bennett goes on the left-hand side. Bennett now going. The green jersey of Sam Bennett is looking for the stage. Bennett, the green jersey, wins on the Champs-Élysées.
Shane Lowry's trainer Robbie Cannon dissects what the US Open outcome means for golf as we know it, as Bryson DeChambeau lands his first major.
Bryson DeChambeau is indeed a US Open champion at Wingfoot.
Mike Ross and BJ Botha pick up the pieces of a disappointing Champions Cup weekend for the Irish.
Now there's an opportunity here as he races inside the 22 metre line and it's good, goes for the corner on the near side of the pitch, gets in for the try. That's a sensational score and he just saw the space opening up in front of him, backed his own pace and Alice Good has got in for a sensational try for Saracens in the corner.
And in football we've live Premier League and plenty of action to review with Stephen Kelly.
Penalty award stands. It'll be a hop, skip and a jump by Jorginho and it's saved. Jorginho repelled from the spot for the first time in his Chelsea career. Alisson with the save. And Chelsea's opportunity to halve the deficit with 10 men is denied.
Game on 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game on 2FM. Marie, there was no championship action even in Clare this weekend. So did you find a highlight? Was there anything that highlighted your weekend for you?
There was a few good GA matches to be fair, but I don't want to put them down as a highlight, you know, in case I end up doubling down as a highlight again next week. More GA. Look, my highlight, it wasn't really a full-blown highlight, but it was definitely an enjoyable kind of moment. Look, the Ireland women, you know, I was looking forward to go and seeing them playing against Germany, the second best team in the world, although they did look like the best team in the world, have to say, on Saturday. The Ireland team were down 3-0 by half-time, and I just thought when they came out after for the second half that it was going to get a whole lot worse, and it didn't. And I just kind of enjoyed seeing them actually react in a very positive way to a difficult situation, playing against a team that were, I suppose, fitter, faster, stronger, better footballers than them and had done a lot of damage in the opening half, and they're able to come out and react really well and kind of settle things down and shore up the defence. And I just thought they gave a really good account of themselves. And, you know, I've got a huge interest in women's football and I've been watching it progress for quite a while now, and I just thought it was a sign of progress. Okay, it wasn't a result, but it was still a decent enough second half performance against a team that, you know, are arguably the best in the world, even though they are ranked number two.
They looked like they'd learnt a lot in the first half. Almost the pace, the tempo, their defending, even the goalkeeper. Everyone looked to be much sharper after having 45 minutes playing against Germany.
Yeah, and like that's a lot of positives to take out of that. And in fairness to Vera Pauw, like she'd said all in the lead up to the game that it was going to be difficult, that realistically, look, they are going to be up against much stronger opposition. She never for once said that they were going to come out and beat Germany because, you know, it wasn't realistic to think that. Like a draw would have been an absolute miracle. But just the positives that you mentioned there were very heartening to see. Qualifying for a major tournament is still something that they want to get to. It'll be a big moment for women's sport when Ireland do end up at a Euros or a World Cup, and you hope that it is this time around. And you know, they have gone a little step closer by not conceding a huge amount of goals, because Germany put 10 past Montenegro, they put an aggregate of 16 past the Ukraine. So like it could have been very damaging to their qualification hopes, and you know, it wasn't as bad as it could have been, and just the fact that they reacted, they made the changes and they looked like they learned was positive for me.
The game against the Ukraine is going to be a big one though. Qualification is going to hinge on that.
Yeah, it will. And, you know, that's coming up now in October. But I think, like, look, it's a loss is always a loss, and there's no point going down these heroic efforts, you know, those kind of narratives, because it wasn't that. It was an exercise, I think, of learning and going up against a team that were so good and been able to come away without being really damaged. And I think they're going to take a huge amount from that as well. And it'll serve them well in the long run, I think, against the Ukraine, because they, you know, they won't have that fear factor, known that they can go out against a team like Germany and, you know, almost hold their own for the second 45 minutes. But yeah, that one's going to be massive. But we're getting there, you know, and it's good.
It will be good. There was loads of other sport at the weekend. Bryson DeChambeau tore up Wingfoot on his own. Everybody else was struggling, but he seemed to be bombing the ball around the place. I must say, I thought Sam Bennett on the Champs-Élysées yesterday was brilliant to watch. I thought it was incredible to watch, actually, his performance through the whole tour, to endure as a sprinter, or a, yeah, basically a sprinter, but to endure the whole tour and to have that much energy left at the last at the end, even, was wonderful to see. What else did I enjoy? I think my own personal highlight was probably watching my own two kids go clear the Hunter Trials yesterday. The rugby, that wasn't overly exciting either, Marie. It was great if you were English or French, but it wasn't wonderful to be Irish.
Do you know what? It was almost kind of facepalm watching it, because all the commentary leading up to the Leinster game in particular was that it was going to be pretty much an easy win for Leinster. They were going to have learned a huge amount in their last 25 wins since losing to Saracens, and then they didn't. And I think everybody was in shock. I don't know if anybody thought that that result was going to pan out the way it did. But even our own analysis here on Friday, like, you know, we were talking high numbers, really, of how much Leinster were going to win by.
Well, so, the blue tinted glasses, instead of green tinted glasses, were you?
I don't know. I don't know what happened. I think everybody got lulled into a false sense of security and maybe overestimated the challenges that Leinster had faced in the last while and how focused Saracens were going to be. And I think there was a lot made out of them losing players, and instead of focusing on what they had and what they were capable of, they were focusing on what they didn't have and off the field. And it just shows the performance they were able to pull out. It was really impressive, but not good, I think, if you're an Irish rugby fan at all. But you mentioned Bryson DeChambeau, and I don't know if he'll be a huge highlight for anyone, because it wasn't the most exciting last day of the US Open, but still, he delivered the ultimate proof of his methods with a resounding victory in the 120th US Open. I think everybody has been making a lot about his 20 pounds of muscles that he piled on. He wanted to become one of the biggest hitters in the game, and he said a lack of accuracy could be countered by being closer to the green. Well, to look at how Bryson DeChambeau achieved these gains, we are joined by strength and conditioning coach to many golfers, including Shane Lowry, Robbie Cannon. Robbie, do you think his transformation is validated now? Because there was a lot of people who were on the fence about it.
Yeah, I guess it's been a great win for him, man. It's been years of hard work just coming to fruition for him. So you can't argue with that win.
Robbie, when you look at Bryson DeChambeau and he's piled on so much weight to obviously gain extra power to hit the golf ball further, is it just as simple as that, as getting weight behind the ball, or how exactly do you do it? I know I can't get it to go anywhere.
Well, I think you got to go back a few years, and I think people don't realise his first year as a pro, he missed 14 cuts. So he had this unbelievable inconsistency. Like, he won a tournament at John Deere, but then he went out the next week and he missed the cut, the British Open, by seven shots. So he realised, okay, there's a lot of inconsistency in my biomechanics here, so I need to make some changes. So he went back in the off season then, and he started working with a guy called Chris Como, and I think he's made his perfect match as a coach with him, because Chris is a very smart, very scientific type of coach, and they went on a kind of journey of a swing rebuild. So like, a lot of people talk about the change in body shape, but the big change in his kind of his swing and his biomechanic has been change of technique with Chris Como. And it was all about reducing variability in his ball flight, because he felt he was very inconsistent. As I said, doing well one week and then having a bad week the next. So that's where this is really the what's really happened with him, in my view.
When you get the club as far back in the backswing as Bryson does, and as wide as he gets it, that also opens scope for things to go even more wrong.
Yeah, so like, when it comes to his training, so he's a big fan, the trainer that he works with, a guy called Greg Ryscott. So their whole kind of method with their training is training end of range. And you would have probably done a lot of that, Ruby, on some of your kind of rehab in Santry. So a lot of isometric contractions, just trying to get them into a very vulnerable position and getting really strong in that position. So as you said, like, there is once you go into that end range of motion, you are open up the risk of hurting yourself. And that's why I think he has gone on this kind of journey of putting on a lot of mass and a lot of muscle. There's a lot of fat in there as well. Like, don't think it's all muscle.
So
he's just really gone down that route just to try and make himself as stable and as strong as possible, because he has gone down the route of getting his positions in his golf swing into that end of range. And the reason for that is when you get into that end of the range, you lock it in and then you can control the ball flight. So, like, yeah, he was driving the ball long, long way the last few months, but he has hit so many iron shots so close. And that's been the secret to his kind of turn in form.
So how does he develop further from that? So, you know, he does have a huge amount of muscle, but as you mentioned, that he has some fat as well. Does he end up turning that into muscle as well?
Well, he's not going to turn the fat into muscle, but I'd expect him to lean up a little bit, definitely. Who knows? Like, this guy is just a complete scientist. And I think they're probably only on the start of this journey, himself and Chris Como. And they're just trying to, as I said, it all goes back to, like, he's not doing this for looks. He is doing this because he wants to be the best golfer he can be. And it all goes back to their biomechanics. And he wants to have his actual swing as repeatable under pressure as possible. So you could see last night his swing was pretty repeatable. As Matt Wolf, he got underneath the plane a little bit on the back nine under pressure, kind of collapsed a little bit for him. Whereas Bryson, his swing was just so repeatable.
Robbie, when I look at it and I think about it and I go back to your S&C background, when you put as much weight as he is to his frame and you open his swing as far as he's open it, so it's his top half of his body going against the bottom half, the stability's in the bottom and the swing is in the top, how far can you push that before something snaps?
He is opening up the hips a good bit as well. He's not completely going like just really resisting with the lower body. Like, he is allowing that lower body to turn. But he's changed his technique completely compared to where he was like 2 or 3 years ago. He kind of came out with this new action in Dubai a couple of years ago, and just everyone was like, whoa, he's just hitting it so far. And obviously a new body shape. But yeah, like, it goes back to what I said about putting your body in that vulnerable position where he is working on at that end range. And that's where I could see it could possibly break down. And as he gets older, he might rein it in a little bit. He might try and get to a certain kind of mile per hour with his clubhead speed and just try and rein it in a little bit then. But I still don't think he's finished experimenting. I think this is probably still quite in its infancy.
What does that mean for the other golfers now? Are they going to look at him and think, right, that's the way that I should be approaching my game?
No, I definitely wouldn't go down that route. This guy is a scientist. He is always going to be looking at different ways how he can improve. As I said, he's got the perfect match in Chris Como. Also, he's got the perfect match in the trainer that he works with. So they're going to go down this route, and obviously it's been very successful. There's 99% of golfers, if they tried to go down this route, they could end up doing themselves more damage. Some people could get injured. So it's the game of golf is one size does not fit all. And whatever has got you to a certain level, yeah, you can try and experiment and try and get a little bit better. But in extremes, lay danger. I've always said that. And this guy he's gone down extreme, but he's had success. But I think most golfers who are playing on the PGA Tour, yeah, they'll try and get better. They might try and get a few more yards. But I can't see too many of them going down this route.
Clear that, Ruby, now. You might as well not bother.
I'll give up, Marie. I know golf gave me up a long time ago, but I'll give it up. But even, Robbie, then when you look at it, right, so I can understand and admire him pushing the science of it and how far you can bring it. But then when you listen to some of his interviews after, and I don't know, I just can't cope with the, I put it exceptionally, I heaping the praise on himself. Does that have to come with a scientific mind as well? Can he not just throw some bit of gratitude out there? I was a little bit lucky, or no?
Yeah,
have to be
yeah,
so?
Like,
processes.
To be honest, I'm most impressed with his putting the last 6 months. He doesn't seem like he's missed any putts. It's just unbelievable. It's just so solid. And even his putting is a little bit unconventional. But yeah, like, he's obviously a very different guy. Like, you look at his speech last night, he started by thanking his sponsors. It was good that he thanked Chris Como, especially. You could see how much appreciation that he has for him. But I guess, like, the one kind of negative thing I thought last night, like, it took 4.5 hours for a two ball. And I thought how slow he played actually may have put off Matt Wolf a little bit, you know. So I was amazed that they weren't putting the clock, because they finished quite a good bit behind the two ball in front of them.
OK, well, let's see what hear what Rory McIlroy had to say about it all.
I don't really know what to say, because that's just the complete opposite of what you think a US Open champion does. Look, they, you know, he's found a way to do it. Whether that's good or bad for the game, and I don't know, but it's just it's not the way I saw this golf course being played or this tournament being played. And yeah, it's can't really wrap my head around it.
Robbie, doesn't matter whether it's good or bad for the game.
Yeah, I think there is talk now. I think they've came to some kind of decision, the RNA and the USGA, so their golf's ruling body. So McGinley kind of touched on it on the coverage over the weekend, that they've come to some kind of decision about reining. It could be the golf ball, it could be the equipment. So they're definitely going to try and rein it in, because there's a lot of golf courses now that are completely obsolete because they're hitting them so far. And they don't want that, because, like, there's so many classic golf courses. Like, for example, St. Andrews. Like, if Bryson went and played there at the moment on a calm day, like, he'd be driving 2 or 3 of the greens, you know. So they obviously don't want that to happen. I'm not sure when they're going to release what they're planning to do, but I definitely think there's going to be some kind of restrictions coming in. So,
but if he's not driving the greens, he's hitting most of his shots to within a pitch and wedge 9-iron range anyway, so his chance of hitting it close are even higher, and that would back up his putting stats. So there needs to be some way of getting him back to hitting 6, 5, 6, 7 irons into the greens.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, because he's hit it so long, so if they do rein it in a little bit, and he's still going to be the longest, so he's still going to be hitting it a shorter club to the green. So, yeah, it's a very tricky one, and I'm glad I'm not in the RNA and the USGA's book trying to help with this. So, who knows? It's interesting times.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the man himself on why science works for him.
As difficult as this golf course was presented, I played it beautifully. Even when I got in the rough, I was still able to manage my game and hit it to correct sides of the greens, except on 14 today. My putting was immaculate today. My speed control, incredible. That's why we work so hard on my speed control. You see me out there on the greens with the device controlling my speed, trying to control my speed. It's just something that allows me and gives me comfort to know that on this green, or these speeds of greens, you know, it's going to be repeatable. It's going to be this, it's going to be that. And so it just gives me comfort in knowing how far I can take it back and go through. And so many times I relied on science, and it worked every single time.
Ruby, do jockeys not talk like that?
Marie, do you know any successful power sports person that stays successful for any length of time that is that confident?
I don't know, Robbie. Is he got confident in real life?
To be honest, I haven't spent that much time with him. Yeah, like, I suppose he is very, very confident in his ability, and it goes back to being a scientist, and he's probably getting a lot of confidence from the science. As he said, he mentioned that repeatability. Yeah, he's still quite young, and I know he's not everyone's cup of tea, but you've got to admire what he's done, and maybe as he gets a little bit older, he'll start to have a little bit more gratitude and be a little bit more thankful. Like, I think deep down he probably does have a lot of that in him, but it might take a couple of years for it to come out to the Open.
Well, he is the US Open champion, so he's definitely doing something right. Robbie Cannon, thanks so much for joining us. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're back with Sam Bennett and cycling.
With Green Farm, a 100% natural range of cooked chicken, turkey and beef. Natural protein, your way.
Game on 2FM.
You're all over the place in a moment as you cheer these guys on and punch the air. Somebody's going to be doing that. Here we go. Oh, it's just about 500 metres to go.
This is it, buddy.
Come on, Sam. Come on, Sam.
Now going on right now as Michael Moorcock picks him up. The other side wants to be in the frame here.
I'm heading there.
There he just looks out.
Oh, my, Sam.
Come on, Sam.
Come on, Sammy. Come on.
Come on.
Come on,
yeah.
That was Sam Bennett's granddad, Pat Cashin, cheering as he watched on from his home in Tipperary yesterday. Now, today, all around the country, people have been celebrating the incredible achievements of Sam Bennett in the Tour de France. Declan Quigley, cycling journalist, and Ronan McLaughlin, friend, former teammate, and a little bit of a mentor as well, I think, of Sam Bennett, joins us now. Incredible scenes yesterday in the Champs-Élysées. I don't think Sam could have asked for a better finish to this race, Ronan.
Certainly not. Well, first of all, I think that's the biggest compliment I've ever gotten. Now, I might have been some sort of a mentor, so thanks for that. But yeah, certainly that was incredible to see yesterday. You know, I actually remember Sam talking about the Champs-Élysées stage and how, as a sprinter, that, you know, that would be his, you know, perfect place to win, and he actually pulled it off yesterday. And not only did he win on the Champs-Élysées, but he won in the green jersey, which. Very, very rarely happens that the green jersey wins on the Champs-Élysées, coincidentally, given that, you know, that is sort of unofficially considered as the World Championships for sprinters, and unofficially the green jersey is sort of seen to be the best sprinter's award, so to speak, even though it rewards consistency rather than sprinting. So, yeah, it was just incredible to see him win such an iconic stage in the green jersey.
Ronan, I was watching footage this morning on, I'm not sure where, but the camera was definitely, it was on, I'd say it was one of Sam's lead outriders, and it brought you the last sort of kilometre and a half with Sam directly behind him. But to me, it's called sprinting, but to see how far out they were building up the sprint, like they were sprint, and they might have sprinted the last 100 yards, but that race was getting going for a long way.
Yeah, it certainly is, you know, and it sort of, it builds up like a crescendo almost, in that the lead outs now seem to be starting further and further from the finish, and the speed really ramps up, you know, even as far out as 20, 30, 40 kilometres from the finish. You know, you can see the bunches lined out in one long line, and that indicates that the speed is incredibly high, and then, you know, it's only going one direction from there on, and that's faster and faster. And as they come on to the Champs-Élysées, like they're sprinting at 60, 70 kilometres per hour, and the TV doesn't do it any justice, and that it is actually slightly uphill in that sprint. And the side-on shot that you get on the Champs-Élysées is one of the few shots in modern cycling that can actually capture somewhat the speed that they're sprinting at. And we've seen that yesterday as well. It's the speeds are just unimaginable for most of us. But then the sort of Sam thinking and all sprinters' understanding of what's going on around them at that speed, you know, they're 2-3 centimetres from the rider either side of them and rider in front and behind them, and they can read what's going on. They can make tactical decisions in a split second. Sam was saying that his leader man, Michael Murku, took him on to the last straight in perfect position, but he felt he was a little bit too far forward, so he let the Trek guys come alongside him and then almost used them as his lead out. And, you know, I've been in sprint finishes, and you can just about, you know, remember to keep breathing and not hold your breath, and, you know, try to keep yourself upright. But to have that sort of clarity of thought and be able to work that out, you know, with such extreme pressure on your shoulders at such high speeds is just, I think the cameras give us some sort of an insight into it, but it's probably hard to comprehend for the vast majority of us.
I was struggling to breathe just watching it sitting on the couch, so I don't know how he was able to do it on the bike. But Declan, like, you could see as well, okay, there wasn't a huge amount of fans or anything around, but like there was lovely shots of his teammates, and you could just see what it meant to them as well.
Oh, it's absolutely massive, and it is a team sport, so you have to understand it. He couldn't have done that. It was Kasper Asgreen did the most extraordinary last couple of kilometres as well, and managed to get Murku as close to the line as possible before he unleashed the lead out, and then Sam was able to, as Ronan has so graphically and brilliantly explained it, Sam was able to drop back, pick up the two Trek guys, and then go again. He got to a new place with that yesterday. I mean, his victory on stage 10, we saw the emotion, but the relief that, you know, was just came pouring out of him at that moment, that he finally delivered the victory. To back that up with another success, for it to be, of all places, on the Champs-Élysées, he's one of only six riders that have ever won on the Champs-Élysées in green. So it doesn't happen every year. I mean, Peter Sagan has won the green jersey in the past without winning a stage at all. And that's so that's not that unusual. Now he's done two stage victories. It's taken Sam, I think, to a new place. The confidence was just oozing out of him yesterday. You could tell that, and the way, you know, you have to understand that he beat the world champion Mads Pedersen, who mightn't be, you know, super famous as a bunch galloper, but behind him again with last year's winner in Paris, Caleb Ewan, He's won two stages of this race. Behind him again, Alexander Kristoff, winner in Paris in 2018, already a stage winner in this race. He put all the gallopers behind him, and he was ticking the boxes of some of the best sprinters in the world. And he proved that he was coming through the 3 weeks and getting stronger relative to his other competitors, just getting stronger and stronger. And I think partly that's because he's got the endurance, he's got the physical ability, but also it's because his confidence is now at an exalted level. And he's delivered for his teams now in the last three Grand Tours that he's been in. He's been a multi-stage winner, so he's consistently delivering. And for him to do that as a member of the De Koninck Quick Step team, beating the team that wouldn't allow him to go to the Tour de France, Bora Hansgrohe, beating Peter Sagan, who created that glass ceiling that he couldn't burst through, is just going to be an amazing sense of satisfaction for him, for his team. I think also for everyone around him, I just, you know, shout out as well. We've heard a lot from Helen and Michael Bennett in the last couple of days, and Tara, obviously, his wife, has been supporting him since they were kids. His coach, Michael O'Loughlin, Martin O'Loughlin, I should say, down in Carrick, has been a great supporter. Bobby Power, the late Bobby Power, who helped him, Dan Curtin and all in the Kanturk Cycling Club as well, who had him for a little while, and Kurt Bogart, of course, who helped Ronan in his career as well, and helped Sam to push him up into the big show alongside Sean Kelly. They must have a great sense of having really achieved something, and that everything that they, you know, all the effort that they put into it was so worthwhile.
Ronan, we heard Sean Kelly speaking yesterday about what this will do for Irish cycling and how Irish cycling needs more youngsters and racers more so than people just cycling. Do you think it will have the knock-on effect Sean hopes it will, or is that optimistic thinking?
I think it will. You know, there's it certainly, it takes some huge results to get often to inspire a nation, and, you know, it's irrelevant of what sport it is. You often see that when we have, especially in Ireland, you know, we're very proud of our own, and then when we have someone performing on an international stage, it can be quite inspiring, you know. But at the same time, Cycling Ireland are making huge strides and sort of pushing forward, and a lot of sort of development work and maybe not seen on the ground as of yet, but there is, I know there is a lot in the sort of pipelines, and a lot of work and ensuring that, you know, everybody who wants to try cycling has the opportunity to do so, and then when they get that opportunity, that they then have a place or a club locally to welcome them in. But, you know, it's also, we've heard lots about the club in Carrick there over the last week or two as well, and, you know, it can't be overstated the role that the Carrick Wheelers have played in Sam's development and giving them that opportunity to start with. And that's one of the great things about Cycling Ireland, is that we have clubs locally all over the country, and not only will it inspire young athletes to get on bikes and try cycling, but it'll also hopefully inspire local clubs to, you know, give kids an opportunity to try out cycling, and that combination hopefully will mean that, you know, we've got a bright future ahead in terms of Irish cyclists. And, you know, it might not have captured nationwide press coverage yesterday, but there is already some serious talent coming through the pipelines, and just yesterday, Ben Healy, who last year won a stage of the Under 23 Tour de France, yesterday won a stage in the Ronde de Lézard, and as Declan was mentioning there, he's also supported by Kurt Bogaerts, who's done a lot for Irish cycling, and, you know, already Ben Healy looks like he could be on the pathway to great things as well. Not quite the same as Sam, and that he's maybe not considered to be a sprinter, but certainly there is a wave of talent coming through that hopefully now will have the opportunity to make the most of the talent that they have.
And Declan, do the exploits of Nicholas Roach, Dan Martin, now Sam Bennett, do they open opportunities for Irish riders to get places on the big European tours?
Unquestionably, and I think Cycling Ireland will certainly try and make the most of this opportunity to get as many people on bikes, and as Ronan says, give them the opportunity at least to explore their ability in racing situations. Certainly, I mean, if we've got a bit of a conveyor belt coming and riders coming up through continental level and winning races like Ben Healy, he's got Eddie Dunbar at World Tour level, and I think we're about to break through and, you know, score some big successes with the Ineos Grenadiers squad. What Nicholas Roach did over the last couple of weeks, 3 weeks, with the Sunweb squad in helping them to produce a series of stage victories can't be underestimated. He was on the front as well in the latter stages yesterday. Some stunning stuff. So I certainly think there's a big opportunity here. And I actually, if it hasn't already started, I want to start the campaign for Sam Bennett to be the RTE Irish Sports Star of the Year for 2020, because I would be amazed if any Irish sports person manages to achieve the level of international success that we've witnessed in France in the last 3 weeks. And who knows, there might even be a few more wins for Sam between now and the end of this crazy little season we've got.
Well, he picked a good year, seeing as nothing really happened this year, so he's pretty much, I'd say he's a pretty warm favourite now, that's it.
Ronan, have you been talking to him? Have you been talking to him, Ronan?
On and off, just text messages now. I haven't actually been speaking to him. I think he's probably inundated with calls and texts and media requests and all sorts, but I know he's just absolutely delighted with how the whole Tour de France has gone, and then to cap it off that way, you see, you know, it goes without saying, obviously, what that meant. And you know, we've seen on TV last night just what it meant to the whole Carrick and the whole of his family, obviously, as well. So and I think the World Championships is next on the cards for him, and certainly, you know, some of the course in the World Championships is quite hilly, and there, I think there's 4,000 or 5,000 meters of climbing on it, so might not be best suited to Sam's talent, but definitely there, you know, some of the riders that Declan mentioned, Nicholas Roach, Seti Dunbar and Dan Martin, will be up for that one, and certainly the way we've seen Dan come through the last week of the tour, they're getting better and better all the time, coming back from injury, suggests that he might be, you know, in place for a good ride in the Worlds, and Eddie as well, especially you know, he was on target to go to the Giro d'Italia next, and he unfortunately broke his collarbone last month, so he's taken a step back from the Giro team. But I know he's still in good condition. He'll be walking towards the Worlds as well. So it's not the end of the year in terms of Irish cycling. There's plenty more to look forward to. And you know, after the Worlds, we do have the other two Grand Tours. So. And plenty more on the horizon as well.
Well, we'll have plenty to chat about tomorrow, because we're hoping to have him on the show. Ronan McLaughlin and Declan Quigley, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein your way.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. There was a load of games in the Premier League last weekend, and of course Marie's beloved Liverpool were handed 3 points by Chelsea. Stephen Kelly joins us on the line. Stephen, I think they gave him the 3 points. What do you think?
I think they did. Kepa again for the goal was just criminal, what he did, giving a ball away like that, and you know, especially a team like Liverpool pressed so high to take a risk like that, it was crazy. But you know, and the sending off, stupidity, they did hand them the points. But Liverpool again, you know, march on.
That Christensen was wearing blue. I think he thought he was playing for Leinster, not Chelsea.
I think he did. And Donegal would have been patting him on the back for that tackle, I think.
Definitely.
But there's a reality there for Chelsea as well. And when you think that Frank Lampard's £200 million spending spree was designed to show that they can challenge the top teams like Liverpool, but it was actually kind of a brush at reality, really, for him, wasn't it, Stephen?
Oh, it was an absolute wake-up call. And you think all the money they've spent, and I'm sure, and you can see they're getting a lot of stick in the media, Thiago comes on at half-time and gives a masterclass in passing the ball.
75 passes, so he completed more passes than any Chelsea player managed in the entire match.
Broke the record for passes in a single half of a game. You know, when you look at the type of business that Liverpool have done and they've been able to achieve, and you know, it's after one half of football we're seeing his praises, but how good he was for Bayern last season. The fact that they were able to get him surprised me, because Bayern were amazing last year. Were the best team in Europe, and Liverpool got hold of this guy for what seems like a steal and a sense of value, and what he can bring to the team is remarkable. And you look at what Chelsea have spent. Don't get me wrong, they've bought big name players that are proven on the European stage, but it's a lot of them to come in and mix together and get to the culture there that Lampard wants to achieve that club.
Stephen, there was plenty of VAR decisions at the weekend for handball and their various games that looked suspect to me, but I think the ref was spot on with Christensen. We've touched on it already, an initial yellow and then given red. VAR works when it's used at the right times.
Yeah, I, that, listen, we had this discussion last weekend as well, when they rescinded the red card and brought back to yellow. At times, you're like, oh, it's fantastic when it's there because it's used to the right time. It's got spot on. But then on the other occasions, you're thinking, how are these decisions made? Like, players are going to have a straitjacket incorporated into the jerseys not to give handballs away. It's ridiculous. Like, it's just bouncing up and hitting them and it's a penalty. Some of the decisions are madness, and how VAR can get those wrong. So you're literally such a fine line, because one moment you're praising it for getting decisions right that sometimes would be a miss because it happens too quickly, but then the other ones they're pulling back and giving against players like Matt Doherty's handball. Like, he's doing what you're actually coached to do from the age of five as a defender, is put your hand on the player, feel and make sure he's there, and then a ball bounces up and hits him in the hand, it's a penalty against him.
Well, that was about the only thing that went wrong for Spurs. The South Korean Son Heung-min was on absolute fire.
Second half of that game, like, they started off not great in the first half, to be honest. They were a bit sluggish the second half, though. Harry Kane and Son were just, they were unplayable. Some of the passing from Kane, his vision, first time releasing of Son, and then Son's movement, and then his finishing when he went through on goal was just exceptional. Like, he really is an absolute star of a player. Like, he's got so much going for him, pace, strength, great with both feet. Dynamic, he takes so many boxes, and for Tottenham, they're so lucky to have a player like there in the ranks.
He's able to finish so many ways as well. You know, you just never know what he's going to do. There are two games on tonight as well in the Premier League. Aston Villa and Sheffield United are currently nil all with 41 minutes gone. John Egan got a red card very early in the game there, and then Wolves and Manchester City is on later on this evening. Dele Alli, Stephen, it's a conundrum really for probably himself more than anybody, because he seems to be way down the order of preference.
Yeah, when you realise that he's not been in the matchday squad for two games, the first two games of the season, and he's fit and he's healthy, and he's going to be playing, I think, in the game in tonight, I think, or tomorrow.
Tomorrow against Leighton Orient, might be called off because there are some potential coronavirus cases on the Leighton Orient team, so we're kind of waiting for confirmation on that.
Yeah, that. But he is down to play in that game, so you think he's not being picked based on squad rotation, just they don't think he's going to fit into that team, and you kind of feel how far he's coming on the pecking order. He was one of the first names of the team sheets for Tottenham a few seasons ago, but his form has let him down. He's dropped off and he's not been the same player, and they kind of felt when Mourinho went back in there he would have got that the old Dele back, because I suppose Mourinho had a player like Frank Lampard for years at Chelsea, and Lampard developed into him and became this goal scoring midfielder, breaking into the box late. When I saw Mourinho go to Tottenham, I thought, you know what, he can do the same with Alli. He can get that role from him where he joins the league. People call him a forward, but I always felt him as like a high midfielder, almost like Lampard. It makes really good runs, gets into the box, times really well, good finisher, but he's just been so off the pace, and you know, it looks like he could be on his way out, which is crazy to think, considering how high regard he was there not too long ago.
Wilfred Zaha scored a brace to sink Man United on his Crystal Palace return to Old Trafford, but I must say the penalty was no penalty.
No, it wasn't that. I have to agree with you there, Ruby. No, not a chance. But, you know, again, United, another team that looked off the pace. Palace, I think that's three seasons in a row they've gone there and come away with a result at Old Trafford. And Roy just seems to have their number. But he just has them set up in a really good, organised fashion. He allows Zaha to have a bit of a free role and implement the way he plays the game. And, you know, he is a star. He really is. And someone that, you know, Man U couldn't get the best out of, but policy seems to thrive.
Gary Neville said after the match about Lindelof and Maguire, you can talk about Jadon Sancho all you like, but until they get a centre back in who can run and defend one-on-one, you're never going to win a league. And I think going on the performance of Lindelof and Maguire, he makes a good point.
Oh, he absolutely does. And that's when the price tag that Maguire came in on was always going to make him, he's going to be in the loads of scrutiny because he was so expensive. But then on top of that, his performances, have they been up to scratch? Have they been as good as what Manchester United need? And the Lindelof beside him, was he ever going to fulfil, you know, the void that's there? And when you, in comparison, when you look at Liverpool and someone like Van Dijk, you just think that Man United are way off that. And if they want to progress and they want to go forward, they need to have a centre-back pairing that are going to be able to be as solid to let the rest of the players get forward and link in and play creative football.
Yeah, but Greenwood should have scored. It was never a penalty. It should have been 2-2, and that would have been a point to United. But moving on, Everton and West Brom, that was some game, Stephen. There were some great goals in this one. Dominic Calvert-Lewin got a treble, but you could pick any one of the seven goals scored there and said, wow.
Yeah, any one of them. West Brom, I actually got to watch them quite a lot last season. They have some really good quality in the squad. Pereira is, on his day, he's such a fantastic footballer, and his quality possesses fantastic free kick from him, but all around there's some just brilliant goals, and everything just look like a different machine altogether. They look like the team that we've talked about for the last 10 to 15 years that might be knocking on the door or pushing one of those teams in the top six out of position, and they finally look like they could be actually a bit able to do that.
Seven goals in the Leeds game as well, and we mentioned the Spurs game a little bit earlier. Do you think that it's not having fans there is encouraging people to be a little bit more adventurous?
Maybe, or maybe defenders have been a bit like last
maybe that too,
because
yeah.
the fans aren't on their back telling them to get the finger or make some tackles. I don't know. It's a strange one. Like, the amount of goals that are going on is phenomenal. Listen, if you're a spectator and you're neutral, it's amazing to watch. But is it shining a massive light on defensive frailties and teams? How, either the attack is so good that you just can't defend against them, or else defensively teams are just not working hard enough. And for me, you can see there's gaping holes in teams' defense. There seems to be a lack of cohesion. Players don't seem to be communicating with each other. Nobody seems to be taking control of a situation. And for me, it's allowing teams to make runs in behind, runs off the shoulder. People aren't being tracked in midfield, and goals are coming from everywhere on the pitch. But it's fantastic to watch, and it's making the Premier League an absolute spectacle. But for the teams in the bottom, the West Brom, Fulham, and Leeds, they're all the teams that just come up. Sorry, you're kind of looking at them thinking, like, West Brom have conceded 8, Fulham have conceded 7, Leeds have conceded 7, and you kind of think that's after 2 games. If you continue on like that, you've got no hope of staying in the league.
Stephen, Lacazette scored some header for Arsenal provided by Aubameyang, but I thought they were lucky to beat West Ham.
Yeah, they were. West Ham, after all the flack they took in the first game, they really came out and got after them, and Antonio had a couple of chances and always looked a threat to them. And Arsenal, they steadied the ship. They look solid enough at times, and is that man Aubameyang, I think he just always looks a threat. And the cross he put in for Lacazette, it was a great header, but the play from him to find them in the box again was brilliant. And you kind of feel with Arsenal, they do seem to be, their games where you felt they would have lost before on just pure mantle and West Ham getting after them, whereas they seem to have been able to hold on to this one and get a good result.
Man City and Wolves at 8:15. It feels like it's a real pivotal season for Pep Guardiola, Stephen.
Yeah, it really does. And listen, again, we're 2 games in, and it's the conversations we're having are probably crazy. We're going to look back at these in a few weeks and be like, what are we talking about? These teams got but you look at Pep Guardiola and you think that, he has to get off to a good start. He has to be turned a corner and make it look like that Man City are able to challenge Liverpool and challenge the teams around them that have brought in big players, brought in big names, and this team have to perform to the level that he's used to performing them at, and it's just whether or not he's going to be around long enough to see it through.
Well, City will hardly get the present Liverpool got at the weekend, but anyway, they'll probably go and win. Stephen Kelly, thanks a million.
Thanks, guys.
On 2FM with Green Farm. A quick and easy addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein your way.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So Ulster went down to Toulouse at the weekend and exited the Champions Cup, as did Leinster when they faced Saracens. But we've enlisted 2 prop forwards to help us understand what went wrong with Leinster, Mike Ross and BJ Botha. It was Leinster's scrum that looked under pressure, Mike, and they were on the back foot from very early on.
Yeah, it kind of took me by surprise, really. No disrespect to Harrison, but I wasn't expecting the scrum to be as pivotal to the game as it actually turned out to be.
Now, a load of scrum penalties. What can a front row do when it's going that wrong, Mike? I mean, they're an experienced front row, Mike Healy, Sean Cronin, and Andrew Porter. They're internationals themselves, but when you get in the back foot, is there anything you can do about it?
Well, to be fair, I was watching, there's a video going around among a few WhatsApp groups, the bar that was showing the different scrums, and I was looking at it, and for a few of them, yeah, Saris did just dominate them, but other ones, there were, you know, there was a couple calls around whip wheeling, a couple calls around going to ground, so it wasn't as clearly black and white as, you know, Saris dominated Leinster at the scrum. I mean, they did overall, but there's a couple other things going on as well. Couple of times I was watching the back row, Leinster back row was very worried about Billy Bunacola, so at crucial times they came off the scrum and Harrison's double shoved and took advantage of that.
PJ, it seemed to take quite a lot of people by surprise, really. What were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, I must be honest with you, I think I missed a bit of experience up front, Leinster especially. I suppose they Andy Porter's come a long way and he's been playing quite often consistently, but from an experience perspective he was, you know, up against a completely international front row, even though in themselves they are as well. But from experience perspective, I think they lacked a little bit of that up front. They missed Tiger, I think. And yeah, but a bit of unity, and I think that momentum just ran. You know, I think scrums in the game now, we see that, you know, trying to build momentum through your scrum and really tightening that noose as you continue through the, you know, builds confidence. And it showed in Saracen's game how that built on that scrum dominance, you know. And I think having a ref in the middle of the field that enjoys scrummaging, you know, Garthu was, you know, enjoys a little bit of scrummaging, will be alluded to getting penalties, you know, more than often at scrum time.
Mike Leo Cullen said that he felt Leinster got spooked by their poor start. Did you think they were a little bit mentally off that they allowed themselves to get spooked?
Well, you know, if you look at the first kickoff, I mean, they fumbled that and allowed Saris to gain momentum, and then they got penalty straight away off after that. And so, yeah, they just looked a bit nervous in the first half for whatever reason. I don't know why. There's plenty of experience throughout there. Now, there's a few guys there who are making their European debuts. I mean, you guys like Hugo Keenan and two of the back row guys, Will Connors and Quaylen Doris, probably playing starting their first quarterfinals. But there's certainly a good spine of experience there. I mean, obviously, Johnny Sexton, Keane Healy, in the backs, you know, Robbie Henshaw, been around, so Gary Ringrose, even though he's quite young. So there was experience there, but for whatever reason, we had a slow start, and before we knew it, Saris were 15 points up.
PJ, it's always been the same in rugby. It all depends on what 1-8 are doing, and it really looked like Saracens took it to Leinster up front, and that kind of created more space for them at the back, and it put Luke McGrath under a lot of pressure as well.
There's no doubt, and we saw from minute one, you know, they basically taking on six and right down the middle, and I think we saw a similar case with Leinster last week. And basically, Sexton held them up and was a turnover, I think. And this group of guys is really behind and they got that momentum build, and it's really difficult then from a defensive perspective. But, you know, what Saracens really well is they hold on to that ball, really get over the game line, and the physicality that they bring, you know, it's really, you know, they're all big, big size guys and they get over the game line, even though, you know, kind of 4, 5, 6, 7 to ball to 10 phases. And, you know, from a defensive perspective, it's really taxing. So, it needs to be kind of a defence start at that set piece where they did struggle to stop them, and then it was a kind of a run on from that. But alluding to that, I think Leinster just did incredibly well. I suppose, you know, down kind of 22-3 and then, you know, come right back at about the 47 mark. They were still, you know, 22-3 down and come back from that. It shows a massive, you know, part in their game, and they could have easily then continued that, you know, on that.
What does it say, Mike, about the opposition that Leinster have faced in the Pro 14 to date? And do serious questions need to be asked now about the standard in the Pro 14?
I don't think so. You know, I mean, Leinster are always going to do well considering they've most of the Irish team playing with them. It's kind of, you know, they're standard setters. I mean, if you look at the Welsh teams, like they're equally same kind of situation, like Wales are distributed between them. The Wales national team, but for whatever reason, like Leinster would seem to have a very good conveyor belt of young talent coming through, and that's mainly down to the demographics. I mean, Leinster, Dublin's a city of 1 million plus, and like professional rugby is being served well by a conveyor belt of schools talent coming through, and they probably have if a larger population are drawn than the other provinces would. And so that's where you kind of lead to a bit of a mismatch there in the talent that's being produced.
And BJ Ulster went to Toulouse, but Toulouse came out well on top, and Cheslin Colby on the wing, he's some flyer.
Yeah, I think from a fit perspective, it was quite perky there, but I suppose we just saw Tiz and Colby and their checking game, their Toulouse play, and how dangerous they are with ball in hand, you know, obviously playing at home, so that played a big part and off there to travel. But I suppose there's no kind of alluded to them being most likely arguably the best player in the world at the present, and it's, you know, quite incredible how he's playing the game.
Well, guys, we overran and everything else. We have to cut rugby short, I'm afraid. BJ Botha and Mike Ross, thanks a million for taking our call. The semi-finals are Racing 92 v Saracens and Exeter v Toulouse. Marie, we're back tomorrow evening, are we?
We are back tomorrow evening, all going to plan anyway. And Tara Stewart is up next after the news.